radio, and I keep fraying them. And the ICOM wire is too big for the hole on the Elinco power supply. So it's just a question from not operating in the room with other people before, if you know what I mean. But the answer to my question, I got to learn how to solder. 82 to you. Thanks so much for the help.
I'm Ed Roy.
Yes, Ed recognized. I just want to put in my two cents that in addition to using solder to kind of solidify the strands, you might also want to consider crimping. It's a good skill to learn. I have crimped a lot of my power cords, and then they go, a lot of power supplies will have posts in them. So you get yourself a crimping device, and you get ring crimps, and that takes care of it as well. So there's more than one way to skin a cat. Ed, you wanted to say something.
Crimping means you're crimping on a load. What kind of load would you stop rotation to crimp on?
Something like a ring.
I just want to make sure that the person who asked the question to hear his name understands that, in that being you crimp on a load, you don't just crimp it as opposed to soldering. Now, first, you say you don't know how to solder. I would certainly investigate looking into that. I know KNT has actually conducted classes at Ham Radio University on that very subject, as I recall. All sorts of stuff about that, but let me just say, you're probably going to need 5 watts or less iron for working on something larger for those heavy wires you're talking about. Although, if you're patient, you can use a 25-watt iron on the larger wires. And let me just make one point about soldering the end of a stranded wire. There is nothing theoretically sacred about stranded wire versus solid wire. It's only a matter of flexibility. If you ever work with 12-gauge house wire, it's solid. It is a bear to bend that stuff, whereas 12-gauge stranded wire is so much easier to bend. So if you want to make the end stiff, just where you put it in the, where you connect it, that has no downside. It's not like you're playing with coax that you have to maintain a constant heat.
Good advice, Ed, and to discuss a solid wire versus the other variety, you see the difference in something like LMR or coax. A regular LMR 400 versus LMR Flex 400. The Flex 400 replaces the solid center wire with the little teeny ones and softens it up, but it does increase the attenuation just a touch. So you'll have less loss in 100 feet of LMR 400 than you will LMR Flex 400. So there is that little difference as well. But it's not a make or break type of issue.
Yeah, at RF frequency, that is more pronounced. That is 50 cycles or at least.
Yes, indeed. You have the beloved skid effect in action.
I believe you also get skid effect at lower frequencies, too. My point is, you were talking about power cables. So it's not a one-to-one. Like I said, when you're dealing with coax lines, I'm changing the pieces over the place. Whereas you need to have to worry about transitioning by using solder to transition from stranded wire to solid wire at the end.
Yeah, I agree, Ed. Okay, so I guess we handled Alex's situation. As your adventure continues, you know where to find me. So I look forward to hearing further questions and comments from you. Future technical net.
Scott, thank you very much for the help. 82 to you. I'll be clear.
West 1.
Say again?
West 1.
Yes, Paul.
On the soft topic, you know, it's always fun when you're learning. Take two very thin, small, thinnest copper wires you can find, and just, you know, just, they call it thinning. Just put a little solder on one wire, and then a little solder on the other wire, and then get them closer together on the work table, and then just heat it up, and it will like, glue itself together instantly. It'll instantly solder, you know, if both of them are tin, that's the word they call it. They call it tin. It's just, you know, you put a little solder on one and a little solder on the other, and you put the two together, and then when you apply the heat, they'll stick together. And then you just for last, try to pull them apart. It's amazing. You'll realize why people solder things. It's really amazing. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, a capillary action for the most part. It's one of the nice aspects of surface mount devices, and there aren't that many, where, you know, it's theoretically possible to just dab the pads with a mixture of solder and the paste, and you put it over the proper pads. And as you apply a heat gun to it, it usually resets itself and aligns itself with the solder pads beneath it. It almost looks like magic.
And, you know, the solders I use, of course, you know, I don't need any paste. You know, it's all all in one. But it's black. And then, you know, he'll have no trouble. Once you do that, and then you get a hold of that one wire with a bunch of frayed pieces at the end, do what Ed did. He said, you know, crunch it together, and then just solder the ends, and you'll be good to go. You'll see if you buy a radio, you know, the ends of these wires that go into the power supply, you'll see those things soldered, you know. They're already done like that. Back to you, Roy.
Certainly,
Ed.
Some of the newer parts are tiny with tiny spaces. Some of the newer ICs will have pads on the bottom of the chip that there are no exposed leads whatsoever. So there is nothing to solder down. So you absolutely positively must put solder paste on the device and on the pad on the board, line it up, and apply general heat, so there's no other way to attach it. So I'm saying is the replacement for a solder paste is absolutely necessary, whereas if you can see the leads, it is an option, but most people don't bother.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always good to use resin. I mean, that's what we're talking about when we talk about flux, and What Paul is talking about, and all of us have experienced the joys of resin core solder. It's a hollow tube of 6040 in lead, and it has the flux in the center. So when you heat it up, you get a little bit of flux, and you get a little bit of solder, and it works out nicely. You can't just say the solder paste that are used for surface devices, if you just put a ground up tin and lead without the flux, you're going to have a risk of some problems. So if they're manufactured to include a specific amount of flux along with it, so that they kind of clean off and deoxide the surface and cause the capillary attachment of the two contacts and favors the alignment. So I don't even think you could get solder paste that doesn't have flux mixed into it, if anything is possible. Anyone have any terrible stories about modern-day solder, not the good old 6040 that I refuse to stop using?
I do have some comments, not specifically for what you're asking.
Okay, very good.
The solder with the lowest melting point, 63% tin, 37% solder, 7% lead. which I believe has a lot to do with why, you know, sodium wire with solder is known as tin, because it is mostly tin. However, tin is much more expensive than lead, and you'll find different grades. 60-40 is very common, like you mentioned, the 3% tin, 40% lead, and there's just a saves a teeny amount of money. 50-50 is fairly common in the brands, and I've even seen it in reverse, 40-60. Basically, a lot of lead and tin, and it raises the melting point to save money. I think that's false common. But in any event, now the big thing is lead-free solder. In industrial stuff, they've gone to all lead-free solder, and I believe they've upped the tin, and I don't know what they've replaced the lead with, possibly antimony, but I'm just spitballing here.
Yeah, it tends to be the bane of all of our existences for the most part, because the thing is very difficult to work with. Most people just wipe the solder off and they go back with their 60-40. It's a European standard, I think. I think you could get away with lead solder in the United States still, but in places like Japan and Europe, manufacturers have all shifted to lead-free. And I don't know anyone who likes the lead-free stuff, personally.
There's the industrial stuff with wave solder in the machine, not by human hands.
Okay, I thought there was, in Europe especially, just a commercial law that you couldn't sell it because it had too much toxic heavy metals in it. I didn't know it was, consumer goods could get by that. By the way, let me see if I can find out what the hell, 99% tin, 0.3% silver, 0.7% copper, according to this. So, that's a lot of tin.
It probably has a higher melting point.
Oh, yeah, I've heard people complain about that. It does.
And what I'm saying is, industrial soldering, where they just run hundreds of PC boards, they have like a level of solder, and it's actually some kind of turbulence to generate a wave where the board runs over the peak of the wave, and as it goes over it, solders it, and they can control the temperature to a tenth of a degree, and it's all completely automated, and that's where they use it. Whereas in this country, if you want to hand soldering, you'd want to use the old-fashioned type. Now, whether it's legal or not in Europe, or what they do about it, it isn't, I have no idea. Sorry.
Okay, it's just my memory is it's some kind of European standard, I think it's CE or something, and to get certified, it has to be lead-free in manufacturing. But I'm thumbing through Google, and it says it's predicting some entry somewhere that in 10 years, lead solder will be obsolete. Probably not. In the same way that, people wrote about incandescent light bulbs being obsolete, but there are still light bulbs out there. I have one in my oven. It's kind of difficult to put an LED in your oven.
What the hell they solder circuit board?
Industrial effect. That would not apply to like hobbyists. So I think it's a big jump from saying industrial must use it to making it complete by anybody.
Yeah, I think it's more hyperbole. What they're talking about is really commercial products. So eventually, your commercial product, which 99% of the time, unfortunately, are not made in the United States anyway, if they're made in Asia or they're made in Europe, are going to be lead-free. As long as they're the guys they got to deal with the annoying aspects, of course, as you mentioned, they pretty much automated everything. So there are devices that pick up and put discrete components onto the surface of the board, and then they go through a solder bath, and a circuit board is born.
Comment.
Yes, please, comment.
I think what you're talking about, the European standard is called R OHS, I believe. I'm not sure, but I think that's the one.
Yep, you are quite right. It's ROHS. Because I remember vaguely seeing it because a lot of products are approved by our consumer electronics and theirs. So, yeah, it's ROHS.
I think they're two separate overlapping sets, CD and ROHS.
Yeah, okay. But I think it's the ROHS that has the most stringent requirements that I know of.
VDA, could you comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, if you look in the like the DigiKey catalog or some of those catalogs, you'll see that standard listed for quite a few parts. They'll specify that that specification ROHS for lead-free solder. Also, the that point where the melting point is minimum, it's 63% tin 37 lead. I think they call that the eutectic or something like that. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, all of my stuff always was 60-40. That's what I learned to use. I don't know what kind of benefit. It'll melt slightly lower, but I'm sure I could look up what the temperature difference is between 40% and 37%. I have one of those big, heavy, I forget how many pounds, rolls of 60-40. It'll probably last me a lifetime, the amount of soldering that I do. But I mean, for everyone out there in the hobby, you might as well learn to solder. You never know what will come in useful.
Want to hear a fun fact?
Certainly, Ed.
In my old days, when I have to use crimp loads, I've taken to crimping the load and then soldering, which I find, let's just spend $500 for a crimp tool, worthy of, fine watch and quality. The crimps don't really hold, and I find if you're careful, you're going to add solder without interference with the heating of the pin or anything, and much more solid hold.
Okay, a lot of people do that. There's a few people who say don't do that for sundry reasons. In my experiences, crimping tools, there's kind of three classes. There's a crimping tool designed by the manufacturer of the crimps themselves, and those are the $400 ones. There are the cheapy glorified pliers that you can find on Amazon in all kinds of colors, shapes, and sizes. And then there's, to me, is a sweet point. I'm sure you've seen them. They have interchangeable blades. They're ratcheted. I find that they do a decent job if you know what you're doing. I usually, once I crimp things, I give them a bit of a heavy-duty tug. If they survive the tug, I don't bother soldering them. But, whatever works.
Yeah, I wouldn't even bother with the pliers. The other ones are completely unaffordable. But I will admit, when I have used them and the company pays for them, they're beautiful. Middle ground ones I find iffy. Sometimes they're fantastic, sometimes not so much. It's more specifically on exactly what you're printing on what tool. That if the jaws will have like three trim sessions, and some will work better than others, stuff like that.
Yeah, I understand. The variation on your mileage might vary. Depends upon circumstances, depends on the type of thing that you're going to crimp the wire to, and if it has any egocentricities, how good you are or how confident you are on your crimping. You could take that $400 crimping tool, and if you just don't read the instructions and don't give a damn, you could probably screw up even with using a $400 crimper. It's more difficult, but it's still possible.
never underestimate the ability to mess something up if you want to.
But even if you don't want to, a lot of people mess a lot of things up that they don't necessarily want to mess up. It's just, you know, never underestimate the incompetence of the average person or a person in a hurry or a person with other things on their mind. We kicked that horse. Jim, KD2BHD, you have a question or a comment for tonight, Jim?
I do. This is Jim, KD2BHD. But, you know, I've been enjoying this content far better than I think what my question will lead to, which is not an argument. good stuff. Alex, do what you're thinking. You're on the right track. So my question has to do with the comments about 10 meters. My experience on about 10 meters was working in Gotham City for many years, and I got the impression that 10 meters was a kind of a no man's land, pirate ship kind of thing. So I'm curious to hear more about it, but mostly if I just rig up a dipole antenna out of some wire and coax and a splitter, should I put it horizontally or vertically, and you know, how can I use my existing equipment to get on that and see what's up? Back to
that. Okay, I'm not quite sure why it's a pirate. I would say 11 meters is definitely a pirate band, but 10 meters is highly dependent on the sunspot cycles. In the sunspot minimum, all you get is ground wave propagation, in which the orientation of your antenna becomes a little bit more important. If the people you tend to communicate with have vertically oriented antennas, you should get one that's vertical. If they have horizontal, you should get one that's horizontal. When the sunspots are out, though, and you start to get the skywave propagation, that's an interesting one, because there's things like Faraday rotation, which is that the actual polarization angle of your antenna rotates in space as it travels through the ionosphere. So although you might have started out vertically polarized, your signal, when it gets to Texas, might be horizontally polarized. So it becomes less important for skywave propagation. It becomes more important in groundwave propagation, depending upon the people that you tend to come in contact with locally. And I would think that it would be a great exercise to put up a dipole. Or I have a 5/8 wave that works beautifully on my roof. It's only about 25 feet off of the ground. And I'm telling you, I could not find an empty portion of the spectrum this morning. It was insane.
Interesting. I look forward to giving it a try. And the difference between the local and the DX. Let me let it drop. I think I heard identifier pop up. Do I have the repeater?
Yep, I've been hearing you.
Very good. My impression, it was just an impression, is that because of the commonality between 11 and 10 meters, I thought there was a lot of alternative uses of the equipment that might have been a little off. But I have no personal knowledge of that. It was just my impression of what you see in the interesting neighborhoods where you do find radio shops sometimes in odd places. So I have a couple of pieces of equipment that'll work up, and I'll throw something up and give it a shot. I understand you've been there for some time, a little bit of presence. Hope to see you there. Welcome any other comments. My question is over.
How is you?
Yes, Ed?
Back in the day when TV radio was at its peak, I thought a lot of TV is kind of sneaking over to the ham band, 10 meters specifically. So that might have been the thought of what you're referring to. And then as TV kind of faded away, I think so did that problem.
Okay, that's interesting, Ed. Let me just check that I have the repeater. Okay, well, I'll share one of my experiences. Once again, I not every Sunday, but most Sundays at 11 o'clock on 28.380 upper sideband, I run a 10-meter net for my other club. And a while ago, a couple years ago, usually I don't hear jammers, except for this one strange guy who seems to whistle. Doesn't say anything. He doesn't stay on very long. He just kind of whistles. But other than him, the only problem that I've had in the past on 10 meters, 11 meter wise, is there was a gentleman who had such a filthy amplifier that he was overdriving that he was running harmonics all the way from his 11 meter transmission up to 10 meters and interrupting my net. And so I would make semi-nasty comments. And eventually I must have gotten the attention of another CB or something, because some guy popped in without identifying himself and had the brilliant idea that if I didn't like his harmonics reaching me on 10 meters, I should find another frequency. But it just, and he disappeared, thankfully. And the guy fixed his amplifier or bought a new one. Who knows? But so I haven't noticed almost any 11-meter-like activity on 10 meters. And every so often, just to annoy myself, I do go down to 11 meters and listen to what goes on there, and I don't understand it. For the life of me, I don't understand why anyone would do that with their time. There's so many better ways of spending your life than the things that I heard going on 11 meters, but yeah, whatever floats one's boat.
Very silly comment, Roy.
Silly away, Ed.
A 11-meter signal flashing over the 10 meters is definitely real. Problem is, harmonics have a specific definition. It has to be multiple to the base frequency. I think there are terms parasitic and things like that. I'm just saying harmonics is the wrong word. I agree with the sentiment, just to point the border on the vocabulary.
Okay, I'll give you that. I don't know exactly what the base frequency at that stage in his machine was, whether it was so small that it was multiples of it or something, but yes. Somehow, unfortunately, it just came out straight on 28.380. Not 28.381, not 79, but 380. And just by hearing the voice and recognizing the kind of things the guy said, I went right to my pan adapter down to 11 meters, and I found him transmitting down there. Trinitron 17 or some such foolishness. You know, these guys have handles instead of actual names.
Was he distorted on his primary frequency? Yeah, I would assume so.
It's sort of difficult to know how much of it is distortion from the things that was causing me problems. That they all seem to prefer to manipulate their audio with reverb and all kinds of curious things.
What about his bladder?
Well, I couldn't really detect any significant bladder on his own frequency. It was just that it kind of grabbed me up in 10 meters that got my notice. I didn't spend a great deal of time listening to him for a bunch of different reasons, but once I discovered that it was the same transmission, it was a little distorted when it got up to 10 meters, but still understandable enough that I knew it was a CB.
Can I say something a little off-topic but related to what you're saying now about radio protocol?
Certainly.
If you want to hear what radio protocol should be, there are things on the internet now where you can tune in recordings of air traffic control communications, so make us or so incredibly sloppy. It has to be precise. It has to be perfect. It's literally a matter of life and death.
Yes, I agree with you. It's for professional purposes, it does. But for us having fun here today, I mean, this is why I assume Dick ran this net informally. I try to run it reasonably informally. You know, we're not getting paid. You're not getting paid. As far as I'm aware, I'm certainly not getting paid. I just got email saying that my dues are due. So the idea is to have fun. I don't know. Some people have to do everything spit and polish. I understand that. I can kind of focus where spit and polish is incredibly important in medicine and not so much important, like on the radio here.
Agree 100% to what you're saying. If you're curious to what straight radio protocol is, just to compare what we do with it, I think it's an educational exercise but nothing more. No, do not try to follow that level of protocol on the handband. It's unnecessary and actually would be a little bit disruptive. I mean, for example, every transmission you identify there, here on a repeater, it's really annoying.
Some people, they run a kilowatt in their head and say, how to take compression in the audio. It's so loud in the meter and it's really annoying when you're tuning around.
Yes, for some odd reason, a lot of those guys were deeply impressed by 1980s movies, so a lot of pen codes, and for some odd reason, shock jock, because there's a more than a whiff of FM shock jocks from say the 90s. There's a lot of Caribbean kind of overtones as well in some of the people doing it. So it's a curious cultural arena.
Yeah, but I think that 100 watts and good propagation, you can call anywhere, no problem.
Well, it ultimately depends on propagation conditions, because 11 meters is very close in properties to 10 meters. So you could get farther, say, in ground waves by upping it. But, you know, if you don't have good sunspot activity, there's only far, so far it takes you. But, you know, I mean, some of these guys also, I knew a few of them, and they were the type of guys who had these kilowatt audio amplifiers in cars. I'm surprised they had any kind of degree of hearing left. Because I don't know if you could run audio with that much power in a small enclosed car, yet there's a whole group of people who usually also have a CB radio in that car. So, you know, I don't know. There's different people with different attitudes about a lot of things.
Lots of hearing through this much noise and stimulus. That's why so many combat vets go deaf in their, you know, in their 60s and 70s and 80s.
Yeah, it's a chronic problem for basically the entire population. As we all get older, even if we're not exposed to a lot of loud noise, we lose the high-end frequencies, and then the more high amplitude sounds you've been exposed to, the faster it degrades. You could be in war, but it could also be in the music field. Nowadays, you know, a lot of musicians have these ear-fitting, you know, little earpieces, so that they can kind of kill most of the background noise. But, you know, take in enough musical performances and you'll go deaf as well.
I think they hear themselves in these earpieces, wireless earpieces, so they can play to the music and try to get it as perfect as possible.
Well, it depends on the artist. They have a sound system behind them. They have a receiver strung to a belt or someplace, and they could feed them the music without their voice or any permutation. So that's another fascinating field. These molded inserts that just about everyone in the music field seems to be using these, and it's probably a good thing. In the same way that eventually maybe football will invent a far better helmet because Football is a very problematic sport. It damages more. Post-concussion syndrome is all over the place. You only have to see some ex-football players who talk in public, and something's not working there.
Well, ever hear Muhammad Ali talk about, you know, being hit and, you know, I guess maybe his illness, most recent illness before he passed on, was related to boxing.
Yeah, wrestling and boxing and football. Supposedly, there was a guy who did a biography on Muhammad Ali and who said, I haven't seen any proof of it, but it's spread all over the place, that he took approximately 200,000 strikes to the head during the entirety of his career. So, you know, if it's anything close to that, I'm sort of surprised that he was able to say his name.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
For comedy only, I'm thinking that before Muhammad Ali took the 200,000 strikes to his head, he wasn't a master chess player.
I disagree. I remember those days when he was catching plays.
Yeah, he was a pretty good poet. You know, I mean, there's some very smart people who aren't master chess players. I have no idea. He certainly had charisma, and he came up with good lines. I assume this kind of predates some guy writing your stuff for you. Could be wrong. But I remember him being interviewed earlier in his career, and he was damn elegant, eloquent at times.
Yeah, I remember that very clearly. I'm older than you are, Roy, and I remember Cassius plays very, very sharp.
Not as sharp as Ed on the trigger on that microphone. Wow, I can't beat him. No, I got to tell you guys, I'm enjoying the content tonight immensely. Good points. I stand down.
Okay, very good. Not that we actually talk sports or anything like that, God forbid. But you know, at some point or another, a bunch of people are going to have to sit down with football and figure out if there's any way to not have all the ex-players end up being mushed in their skulls. It's really, obviously, you know, they're doing more and more tests for post-concussive syndrome. A lot of retired football players have signed on for autopsies after they die to investigate the degree of the trauma. And so far, they're picking up loads and loads and loads of post-concussion syndrome. So it's something that, you know, the public's going to have to deal with at some point or another. I don't think it can keep on going on like this. Anyway, that brings us to our next person on our list, which is David, KG2RY. What's your question or your comment for tonight, David?
Hello, Dr. Roy. Good evening. I have two parts to the question. One is, how does All-Star work? You know, you can start with a piece of hardware, like a Raspberry Pi and an HT, and you would run it like any of the other digital modes. The other question is, you know, how does the All-Star Link web transceiver, how does it work? Go ahead.
Okay. All-Star, which is part of this system, in addition to being linked through IRLP and Echo Link, we also have an All-Star Link that's operational, so people can visit us using that. It is ultimately just another voice over internet protocol used for the furtherance of amateur radio operators. The other different voice over internet amateur radio protocols have slightly different philosophical bent. IRLP is primarily designed not for the individual, but for the repeater operators themselves. So the people that run IRLP and give out IRLP nodes and maintain IRLP nodes prefer the people to have a repeater. They'll accept experimenters for a few, but ultimately if you say, I would just like to have an IRLP link in my shack, they'll say, go away. EchoLink is the other side. They prefer to have a lot of people having access to EchoLink and to channel into repeaters, both locally and remotely. They do not particularly like people just listening in on EchoLink. They would prefer, if they could, have everyone actually use transmission as well as part of it. Now, EarLink is another IRLP over voice. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, didn't want to time it out. Is another voice over internet protocol for ham. So they have servers. You go in through the internet using a thing that looks sort of like a Raspberry Pi, Pi Star, except that it's a little different. And the software is a little different, and you have to get an all-star node, which they'll give you if you ask. And it's just another server in the same way, in addition to EchoLink and IRLP, that you have when you're doing digital radio and you have a Python. It's just a different server, and it's a different identifier. It's all-star's server. And is All-Star's node identifier, but it works pretty much the same type of thing. You can link repeaters to All-Star. You can link individuals to All-Star. People are linking their All-Star to EchoLink nodes. My other club, the Kings County Radio Club, has a EchoLink node that some guy with an All-Star node has basically sat on for most of the last month or so. So that's the surface. If you got any other questions regarding that or something that I missed, feel free.
Well, I was looking at this thing on the internet. I suspect that you have to purchase the hardware. Then I think they give you a node if you purchase the hardware. What I did was I took an old computer and I took an odd recommended browser software, and I run it with JavaScript, and it works a limited number of nodes available for this. It's called the All-Star Link Web Transceiver, and it works pretty good, and W2VL, the node, it works on this transceiver. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, what that most likely is rather than take your All-Star node and link it to an EchoLink node, he's linked it to his PC. So the same way that some people have WebSDR and other such things, even I think EchoLink might have, there are different groups that try and get a web-based interface, usually they're kind of low-tech and tricky things, and they fail more times than they don't fail. The weirdness with All-Star is that if you find an All-Star link repeater in your area and you use it a while, inevitably some of the guys who listen to you, who maybe talk to you, are going to say, you know, you really should get your own link. I don't know. It just strikes me as a little bit cultish. I could be reading them completely wrong. But yeah, you could do it through web interface. It's not going to be as clean as if you get yourself your own little hotspot that has an All-Star link built into it.
Is there such a thing as All-Star Link software? So you don't need the hardware. You can just use your computer, the internet, and your audio card.
As far as I'm aware, unfortunately, no. I when I was looking for things like that, I could find nothing in either Apple or PC base. They all seem to be written for things like Raspberry Pi and such.
QSL. Yeah, I thought I saw one that said software for PC and Raspberry Pi. But then when I was ready to download, you know, it said that the PC is a Linux PC.
Okay, that makes sense because a lot of times people's Raspberry Pis are operating on Linux. So, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen the other. So I guess theoretically, if you didn't want to dedicate anything to a Linux, you could set up a virtual window. Actually, Windows 11, I think, has a built-in Linux kernel capability that really operates as a virtual machine with a Linux kernel. With newer hardware, you can probably run a virtual Linux and install it inside that, and you might be able to get the ports to work right.
Yeah, but the web transceiver might not work on Windows 11. Also, somebody mentioned to me that when Windows 12 comes out, Windows 10, you'll start to lose the capability to see certain websites, you know, according to the programming and the SSL certificate of the website. Do you know anything about this?
Nothing specific. SSL, we sort of talked about this a few weeks ago. SSL certificates are encrypted. You know, when you go to a website and you see the little padlock and it's closed as opposed to open, and instead of going to HTTP, you're going to HTTPS, which is secure, means it has a certificate. The certificates are published and sold by trusted companies, and they have expiration dates, so that if they do not issue a fresh certificate in time, there will be times where you will not be able to get onto the website because it will say the certificate has expired. Also, you know, if they change the software, if they change the browsers, I guess theoretically they can screw things up. Also, they could try to control who you see and what you see, and put more strict guidelines in what is an acceptable browser to go through their firewalls. So it is possible over time for companies to limit your ability to go all over the place, with the reasoning being that they're doing it to protect you.
QSL. Also, I called Apple and I asked them about it. They said that old operating systems, there might be slight limitations as to the accessibility of certain websites, but they said that it's about the website and not about the computer.
WB2KWC?
Yes, Cat.
Okay, I think we're confusing SSL with TLS. Support for SSL will not be dropped. However, there are different levels of the code. Microsoft is dropping support for TLS 1.0 and 1.1. Which came out, I don't know, somewhere around... I know support was in Windows XP. So some level of TLS will be dropped. I'm not sure when the date is, but you were correct in that some of it will be dropped.
Yeah, but I think also what Apple was saying was, you know,
depending on, I'm wondering maybe also has something to do with the level of HTML and the limitations of a computer to read the HTML code, you know, or whether, you know, there's any other limitations.
And all these things, unfortunately, need a degree of maintenance. If they are maintained, they shouldn't be a big problem. The problem is that there are a lot of sites that are not rigorously maintained.
Well, I was thinking about, you know, the website, the HTML code, and the accessibility from an old operating system, you know. And I guess Apple said that they will support, down to maybe High Sierra or Sierra, which is pretty old.
Okay. You know, I mean, ultimately, all things are transient. So, eventually...
Thank you. thumb drive, and I carry a 2 terabit machine, which has, you know, basically most of the
drive, the mini drive, and in all the RAID drives in the closet, you know, and everything is like double and triple backed up, you know. I don't know how important it is. Maybe at some point in time, I won't need that information anymore.
Okay, sounds like you have a plan. Personally, if I was you, I would consider an additional
soldering gun, so I can solder a connection that came loose for my 10-meter antenna.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the soldering that I've done in my life didn't require something that powerful because usually I was doing some soldering for circuit boards and such. But yeah, if you have large, massive pieces of metal that wick heat away rather quickly, then having a heavy-duty, high wattage soldering gun is a nice addition to have.
Are we getting into Florence Manning territory?
I certainly hope not. Those gas-driven soldering irons have always been a disappointment to me personally.
Oh, I'm just talking about a blowtorch.
Oh, well, when in need, if you need a blowtorch, it's a good thing to have. I have one in my basement. I've had them for many, 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 many years. I've probably used it about 3 times, but I haven't.
I don't know what the equivalent wattage of a half-inch copper pipe is. They work fine on them.
Yeah, but this soldering iron, the soldering gun, I probably never use it after this time.
Oh, well, you know, sometimes it's good to have one just in case. I mean, I've spent more than a few bucks having backup parts for things that, you know, if I needed them, it would be very difficult to get them later on. And sometimes it worked out. It broke, I pull out the old thing that I got to replace it, and it worked. But occasionally, the primary device fails so many different ways that replacement parts isn't going to do anything, and so I end up throwing out the broken, unfixable thing and the replacement bits and pieces that I bought for it. But, you know, it's not like it's ever going to really take up too much space or just kind of be a problem. You just remember where you put it so that if you happen to need it down the road, you know where to retrieve it.
Lovely.
Finally, Ed.
When I was a teenager, a friend of mine's father had like a 200-watt soldering iron, and this was like a weapon to kill somebody with, that the actual